This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks so much for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of August 12, 2024. Shaw Butte in North Phoenix is one of the more challenging hikes in the city's trail systems. Visitors who make it to the summit are rewarded with 360-degree views and a piece of Phoenix history. KJZZ listener Greg Parsons wanted to know the story behind the ruins at the top of Shaw Butte and asked about it via our Q&AZ reporting project. The answer comes from Greenlee Clark.
In 1957, Richard Barker and his wife Barbara purchased 40 acres on the south side of Shaw Butte, near North Mountain. What started as a simple plan to build a house evolved into something more.
I guess he felt he needed to do more with it. So in 1961, he opened it as the Cloud Nine restaurant.
That was Douglas Town, journalist and local historian who wrote about the Barker family and grew to be friends with Don Barker, Richard's son. Don played a significant role in preserving the stories of Cloud Nine. According to Town, he would leak out a little bit of information at a time and was proud to share the legacy with fans.
He was a real nice guy and very generous with his time. He loved the Cloud Nine. He loved talking about it because he was very proud of it.
One memorable aspect of Cloud Nine was the daring nature. This road up the Butte was so challenging, even the cement truck driver wasn't prepared. Barker ended up getting a cashier's check, not only paying for the load of cement, but also for the cost of the truck itself.
He had to drive the truck up the road himself because the guy just didn't trust him.
The road continued to be intimidating once business opened. Don and his brothers would stand at the base of the steep access road, charging visitors a dollar, while Richard drove customers up and down in his station wagon. The Cloud Nine restaurant quickly became a local sensation, not just for its food, but for the experience it offered. From dining to dancing, the view topped it all. Julia Tagger is president of the Sunny Slope Historical Society.
But back then, there wasn't many restaurants that were on top of mountains where you could kind of get a whole 360 view, and the feel of exclusivity was very cool as well.
The restaurant ended up burning down in 1964 under mysterious circumstances. Today, only the ruins remain, but the site has found new life thanks to hikers like David Fitzpatrick. I recently hiked up Shaw Butte with David, who grew up in the area. He said as a young child, his first hiking experience was with his mother to the Cloud Nine ruins, where the walls still stood, but the roof was gone. Now, only the foundation remains. Since 2020, David has hosted monthly full moon hikes up to Cloud Nine through his amazing Arizona Adventures hiking group, which can be found on meetup.com.
I'm blessed with meeting amazing people. I mean, it's not just amazing Arizona adventures, it's amazing Arizona people!
Absolutely.
I love it.
These hikes are more than just exercise. People bring food to share, and there's live music right on the remains of Cloud Nine. Depending on when the full moon is around, David will tie in other festivities into the hike, like tacos for Cinco de Mayo or costumes for Halloween. What never changes is his hiking attire. It's hard to miss David with his signature tie-dye shirts and long ponytail. He wears them to honor his son, Joshua, who passed 5 years ago.
He used to make tie-dye. He was an amazing kid, just an amazing young man. I miss him, so he gets to come with me everywhere.
The Cloud Nine hikes offer more than just a chance to reconnect with nature. They're about honoring memories, building community, and creating new experiences. David's passion for Cloud Nine ensures that this historic site remains a place for people to connect with each other and the natural beauty of Phoenix.
This is my happy place. It really is. That's why. And especially now I get a chance to share it with everyone else. It's just beautiful. I've been blessed with that.
Greenlee Clark, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And you can ask your own question at qaz.kjzz.org. In politics news. The Arizona Supreme Court ruled on Wednesday that the Republican legislature's description of an abortion rights ballot measure does not violate state law. From the Politics Desk, Wayne Shutsky reports.
Republican lawmakers voted to include the term unborn human being in a description of the measure that will go in a voter informational pamphlet. The Arizona for Abortion Access campaign sued, arguing the term is politically charged and violates a state law requiring the legislature to use impartial language. A trial court judge agreed, ordering the legislature to rewrite the description. But the Supreme Court overturned that ruling in a split decision, finding the language approved by Republican lawmakers complied with state law. Chief Justice Ann Scott Timmer and Justice James Bean disagreed with the court majority and would have affirmed the lower court's ruling. Wayne Shutsky, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. You can test your state smarts with our new A to Z quiz. There are two quizzes each week starting on Tuesdays and Fridays. And bonus, you can grab the new KJZZ Play sticker at play.kjzz.org. In business news, some workers at Phoenix's Sky Harbor Airport say they need more protections from extreme heat. Catherine Davis-Young reports.
Phoenix has an ordinance requiring breaks, shade, and water for many outdoor workers at the airport. But unions representing the workers say they want more protections for people who spend time inside hot jet bridges or planes. Speaking at a rally at the airport, Linda Ressler said she was treated for heat stroke last summer after spending her shift cleaning parked airplanes with the AC shut off.
We didn't get to take breaks, and we were told not to take water onto the plane. Sometimes I would drink water left by the passengers because that's all we had access to.
The Service Employees International Union wants these protections beyond just Phoenix. They're calling on the Occupational Safety and Health Administration to confirm new heat safety guidelines for indoor and outdoor workers nationwide. Catherine Davis-Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In health news, ask almost any parent and they'll tell you they'd do anything for their child. For parents of transgender and non-binary youth, that anything could be life-saving. Accepting a child's gender identity can significantly lower rates of attempting suicide. But many parents struggle with their own feelings of grief and loss as they help their child navigate this transition. Kathy Ritchie has this story.
If you're an LGBTQ kid, Stephania Contreras is probably the kind of mom you'd want.
I was back in the day with Harvey Milk and my babysitters, two lovely gay men that lived downstairs from us, like, let's take the kid to the parade kind of thing, you know.
This East Valley mom grew up in an extremely progressive household. Being gay or lesbian was a non-issue. And it was a non-issue for Contreras when her then 14-year-old child came out as bisexual 4 years ago.
The bisexual, the I'm gay, all that, yep, no problem.
Then her child, who was assigned male at birth, started saying that they felt more female than male. Eventually, her teen identified as trans feminine.
The trans hit me because of mainly the health connotations with that, because it was, where is this going to go?
And how far, she wondered.
In my situation, my daughter, or my son was 23, so he was a lot older when he came out.
David Gailey's daughter is now 26 and has since fully transitioned.
Yeah, facial feminization, breast augmentation, hip augmentation. She was very fortunate to have health insurance that covered all this.
Both Contreras and Gailey 100% love and embrace their kids. That'll never change. But they've also experienced pain and loss along the way, like when Gailey's daughter legally changed her name.
And I was the one who picked out her name, so it was really, I really liked her name, and then she called it her dead name, and I was like, oh my gosh, that name's not dead to me, you know, like.
Or when Contreras's daughter asked her mom to put away old photographs.
Like, no more baby pictures out, I don't want to see that person, that doesn't exist anymore, and that just brought me to tears, you know. It really was experiencing the death of my child as I knew that child.
The most painful thing for me is when your kiddo wants to forget everything that reminds them of their past life. So there's this distance that you start to feel, and we're trying to cross that bridge right now, and it's heartbreaking in a way, you know.
Gina Reed is a manager at 1 in 10, an LGBTQ youth advocacy group in Phoenix.
And we do let parents know that there is going to be a grieving process.
In 2020, 1 in 10 started an online support group led by Reed for parents of trans youth, which Contreras and Gailey regularly attend.
It's kind of like decades ago when gay and lesbian kids would first come out, because the world wasn't like it is right now. Parents went through the same thing. They were grieving because they never saw marriage in the picture. They never saw children or any of those things.
But with parents of trans children, Reed says, it's much more complicated. They don't want to mess up, as she puts it, and parents often feel isolated. There's also misinformation, anti-LGBTQ policies and politics, and judgment from friends, family, even spouses. Ellen Kahn is with the Human Rights Campaign in Washington, D.C.
So not only do parents of trans kids have all the fears, like the sort of universal fears, will my kid be loved? Will my kid be safe? There's also, you know, will people blame me? Will people say I'm getting this wrong?
Support groups for parents of trans and non-binary kids are still relatively new, says Gina Reed, but more and more parents across the country are starting to find their own community online. Here's Ellen Kahn again.
And within those groups, they have subsets like trans girls, trans boys, non-binary folks, different age and stages where they're, you know, so they can sort of talk about what their kid is going through, you know, at this moment and what might be some of their unique needs or questions.
Like, what if your child eventually wants a biological child of their own? It was at a 1 in 10 meeting that Contreras first heard about sperm banking.
Definitely that was really helpful for her to know that if she chooses to have children, and she said that she might, and that she likes that, you know, like the thanks, Mom, that you took care of that for me.
Contreras' daughter is turning 18 and life is smoothing out. She started hormone therapy and is feeling more like her authentic self. And like Gailey, Contreras loves getting to know her daughter. So while life didn't unfold the way these parents may have imagined when their child was first born, what matters most is that they each have a child who is happy, healthy, and alive. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Tribal Natural Resources, which is supported in part by a grant from the Katina Foundation. The Apache-led nonprofit that has nearly exhausted its legal options to protect a sacred site from copper mining is traveling across the country on a prayer journey. This week, the group is stopping in Arizona, en route to the nation's capital and the U.S. Supreme Court. Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
Apache Stronghold is meeting with tribes and churches nationwide to share their struggle for Oak Flat, which is considered to be a holy site where Apaches believe the Gan, or mountain spirits, reside. Wenzler Nosey Sr. founded the group.
Many of the people that never joined something like this before, you know, our doors are open to join us because it's a prayer for not only here but around the world.
In March, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed a ruling that the site of the planned Resolution Copper Mine east of the valley is not subject to any federal laws protecting religious freedom. The group's prayer journey ends in September when Apache Stronghold plans to file its appeal to the Supreme Court, which hears about 80 petitions annually. Gabriel Pietrazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From KJZZ's The Show, there's a rescue team that works to prevent deaths and injuries in the Grand Canyon. Co-host Lauren Gilger has this conversation.
People die in the Grand Canyon every year. So far this year, that number is up to 11, above average for the park. But there is an entire team of people there who work to stop that from happening. It's called Preventative Search and Rescue, or PSAR, and they are tasked with trying to teach people how to prepare and plan for a hike in the canyon and to rescue them when there are emergencies, a task our first guest this morning told me is not always possible. Megan Smith coordinates the team. I spoke with her more about their work and the need for it.
The team began in the late 90s, but the park knew that it needed to do something different. They were averaging upward of 4 to 5 trail deaths or heat-related deaths per year, and it was just not sustainable for the staff they had at the time. Rangers from the Inner Canyon weren't able to get to their duty station locations. They were just stuck out on the trail in this endless loop, helping people all day into the night. And the South Rim Rangers were having to go down, leave their duty location and their otherwise important work to go down trail and offer assistance. So they entered in this team in the late 90s, early 2000s, we were starting to formalize more. The team was growing. Now it hovers around 60 to 70 volunteers and one permanent ranger and between 7 and 9 permanent rangers.
So it sounds like there were, you know, many issues with the dangers of hiking in the Grand Canyon then. But have you seen this ramp up? Like we keep getting reports now of hikers being rescued or even dying in the Grand Canyon because of the heat. Like, has that really changed the operation there?
You know, I'm glad that you asked specifically that question, because the messaging, when I look back at old archives and old data and I'm doing research, the messaging hasn't changed a whole lot. Know your limitations. Don't hike between 10 and 4. Pack and be prepared. Have a contingency plan. I look back at these bullets and the font in which they're written has changed a whole lot, but not the messaging.
Have you seen more people getting themselves into tough situations and needing assistance or even rescuing?
Yeah, we're not seeing maybe more calls for service. We're still hovering around about 350 missions per year. Mm-hmm. But what is changing is the situations. People are calling us for more benign things. I would say that people's understanding of what a true emergency is very interesting and open for interpretation.
What kinds of things do they call for?
Well, we've had people that call us because they're afraid of the dark. We have people that call us because their cell phone's out of batteries. It could be hazardous. We understand. And I don't mean to make light of it. We do take people's calls seriously, but we're faced with triaging those. Mm-hmm. And the risk that I want people to understand is we can get fatigued. And if we increase that call volume on an ever-shrinking staff, then when the serious call comes in, we might miss something. We might not be at the top of our game. We might be suffering from compassion fatigue, and we're not able to be at our best, or we might be expending resources in the wrong location for something that's more benign and not able then to pivot efficiently and go to the really serious thing that we would otherwise want to be at or know that we need to be at.
That's really interesting. So that's not the change I expected to hear you talk about. Talk about when it does get serious and the rescues that you have to make. Like, can you always rescue people in the Grand Canyon?
No. In fact, I've been down there overnight with quite seriously injured or ill people, and overnighting somebody that really does need to be flown out and get to surgery or get to the ICU, those are tenuous circumstances to be in. That's really where you kind of test yourself as a provider and a rescuer and your team, and you understand if you're right for this work or not. We get stuck out, and that's a reality. Being able to explain to the visitor or your patient or your patient's family what that means and the why behind it. It could be the weather conditions, wind conditions. It could be light. We just don't fly at night. It could be our resources. There's all sorts of things that would lead us to not being able to come and rescue you or come and rescue you as immediately as maybe you would want.
Wow.
Or your situation might require.
Right. I mean, so do you think that people have an understanding of that? Like, so many millions of people go to the Grand Canyon every year, right? And like, I'm sure a lot of them do a hike or attempt to or do some of a hike, right? Like, is there a sense that this is a fun thing that millions of people do, so it's going to be fine, you think? And people don't really understand the real risks?
Yeah, there's definitely an air of not me, not today, you know, kind of some denial. One of the things that we train our staff here about is this trifecta. We are, for better or worse, very closely and relational to Las Vegas and to Disneyland in California. And you'd think, well, what does that have to do with anything? But if a visitor is coming from across the world and they're going to visit those other two locations, which, by the way, are wonderful locations, but they're very strategically manicured and managed for safety.
Right.
That's not the case here at the Grand Canyon. You have to make those risk management decisions all on your own without walkways and red lights and conveyor belts and escalators and all of those things. So if you've been traveling and you're in the wrong mindset and you come here, one misstep near the edge could be catastrophe, or a short hike that should just be out for a couple hours turns into a big deal.
Wow. You want people to be able to come there, right? Like, though, so it's an interesting tension, because I'm sure you love the Grand Canyon. I'm sure you appreciate the place and want to share it with all of these people from all over the world who come. But it sounds like, you almost want people to come and do this in a certain way, like with a certain attitude. Is it respectful? Is there a tiny smidge of fear you would like people to have?
Yeah. Those would all be more self-protective. Okay. And I think with caution and awareness, some planning, preparedness, it is doable, it is achievable, but you got to be honest with your own limitations and your own abilities.
That's really interesting. So tell us, like, I know there's a long list of things that you tell people to do and to consider. What's at the top of that list? Like, are there things that people just don't think about?
The most common is they don't understand that it gets hotter as you go downhill. I didn't know when I got here. I'm from Western New York, and I didn't even think about this mountain being upside down, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so having some supplies with you makes a big difference. I've seen visitors that are able to pull themselves out of a pickle with very little, but at least they brought it with them.
Like what? Like what?
Oh, duct tape goes a long way. Here, when it gets really hot, your shoe soles can melt off your feet. Imagine trying to hike on a really hot surface that's pokey with rocks and, you know, cactus needles and things. And now you don't have any shoes because the glue is melted and your shoe delaminated. So
oh my God.
Having just a small spool of duct tape, having basic first aid supplies, having your medications that you take on a daily basis. One of the best teachers here is Mother Nature and experiential learning. We give the information. We hope that they take our advice. But ultimately, some people just really need to go learn the hard way or get through it, prove to themselves that they can do it. The one exception there, I would say, is when there are children or animals involved.
Yeah.
We want people to participate in their public lands. We don't want to be gatekeeping in any manner. But there's just some scenarios that we have been here doing this work long enough. We know the math isn't going to add up and end well.
Yeah.
Aside from that, they could have a hard hike and still come out. A few blisters, maybe a little nausea, maybe some vomiting, healthy respect. And then they'll feel a sense of pride and accomplishment. And then my hope is that they return and get into these spaces a little deeper and have a more successful trip the next time around.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. That is Megan Smith, Preventive Search and Rescue Coordinator at Grand Canyon National Park. Megan, thank you for coming on. This was fascinating stuff.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
And finally, InfronTerrace News. Law enforcement and community members in Tucson are reeling after a string of violent incidents that began Sunday when an early morning gunfight left several people wounded. From the InfronTerrace desk, Elisa Resnick has more.
Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos told reporters deputies responded to a domestic violence call Tuesday morning about a man who the caller said had threatened her and waved a gun. Nanos said Deputy Augustine Gonzalez spotted the suspect's car in the same neighborhood 2 hours later and began a foot chase.
In chasing them, he didn't realize that hiding in the bushes, like the coward this man was, he fired multiple times at our deputy. Our deputy's lucky to be alive.
Nano said Gonzalez was shot in the leg but released from the hospital the next morning. Deputies arrested one of the two men they say were involved and are still searching for Gabriel Angel Antimirano, who they say shot the deputy. Nano said domestic violence calls occur frequently.
There's got to be a call almost every day, if not two or three or four calls every day. It wouldn't surprise me if we're well into the thousands of domestic violence calls every year.
Earlier this week in Tucson, a 22-year-old woman suffered fatal injuries falling from her boyfriend's truck in the midst of an argument, according to court documents. Elisa Resnick, KJZZ News, Tucson.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.